Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today I'm pleased to have with us Mr. John Judas. Mr. Judas is a writer of many books on contemporary American history and politics. He has been associated in the past with the New Republic as a senior editor. And today we are speaking about his newest book, The Nationalist Revival, Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. Welcome, John Judas.
Hi.
John, what is the primary thesis of your book?
Well, I suppose it's that we should take nationalism seriously and not look at it simply in its most toxic form as something that caused centuries of war culminating in World War II, but as a basic component of democracy, of advanced welfare societies, of something that can be shaped either from the right, the left, or the center. For instance, you really can't have a functioning democracy unless I am willing myself to allocate to you, who I don't know, I mean, you just called me up, equal power over deciding who the American president is. Or if I'm not willing to spend my tax money to support somebody who is disabled in, let's say, in Reno, Nevada, that the government is going to subsidize, whom I don't know at all. The only thing I know about this person is that they're also an American. Now, if I think that the government is doing, if we get to a situation where people think that the government is supporting people who aren't really Americans, who aren't part of the, or that people are voting who aren't Americans, then we have a situation where the government itself becomes dysfunctional. And, you know, you get this in, you have a version of this in Spain, where part of the country wants to secede, where they don't see themselves as belonging to the same nation. And so in that sense, the national identity is very important for the most basic functions of our country and of other countries. And the question is, beyond that, what do we do with it and how do we shape it? But if we simply deny it and say, well, you know, I don't care, I'm not really an American, or I'm not really German or whatever, then we get into real political problems.
You have an interesting quote, which obviously you don't really agree with, on page 14 from the New York Times, I presume, where in essence the argument is that national identity is not an objective state but a subjective one, and therefore we don't really have to take it very seriously. I suppose you could say it's a bastardization of the Benedict Anderson thesis. Why did you include that?
Well, I just included it, you know, the standard format for writing an article or a book is that most people believe X, but in fact Y is the case. And then you go on and you say why it is, what why is true and not X. So, you know, it's just a stalking horse for trying to say that national identity is something that is central to us, and it can't just be wished away as, let's say, as a myth, which was, I think, was the term that the New York Times used. It's somewhere between, let's say, you know, belonging to a family where you really can't, you can disown your children and things like that, but there is a biological connection. And, you know, at the very other extreme, when you, like I'm from Chicago and I root for the Chicago Cubs. Now, you know, if I get mad at the owner and stuff, I can stop rooting for them. That's at a very other extreme. The nation is closer to family. It's not quite there. Of course, you can emigrate, you can belong to another nation, but it's an important part of us. And a lot of people don't even realize it until, let's say, the planes go into the Twin Towers on 9/11, and suddenly they feel that they have to defend their country. Or, when you go overseas, and I'm sure a lot of people have this experience, and people start running down your country, even though you there's a lot of things that you disagree with about it, suddenly become very defensive. And become defensive because this sense of nationality is something that you grew up with. It's not, it's not genetic, but it's something that's part of your childhood education, and it's important.
Isn't the real problem with the sort of Habermasian post-Enlightenment, post-nationalist humanist patriotism or citizenship is that no one, or almost no one, will sacrifice for it and at bottom, if need be, die for it?
The thing is that ethics and morals have to be founded upon a viable sense of what human beings historically will put up with. And if you build a politics on the basis of the idea that an American should care as much what's happening to somebody in, let's say, Uruguay as they care about somebody happening in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, it's not going to work out. That's Americans have always been skeptical about foreign aid. I think that that might be an extreme example, but I think what you started to see especially in the 90s after the end of the Cold War, was a kind of utopian vision. You had that in Europe with the idea that people could become Europeans as opposed to Germans or Danes or what have you. And it hasn't really worked out that way. It's made demands on people that are unrealistic. It may be in 200 years, all that stuff will make sense. And because of course it wasn't that important, 500 or 600 years ago to be part of, a Hungarian or whatever. That it is in that sense a more modern priority for us being part of a nation. But I'm just saying that right now we're not at a point where being a global citizen and putting global concerns above national concerns is a realistic basis for a politics.
What do you mean by, quote, nationalism as an explicit ideology, unquote?
Well, you get at certain points in history a politics that's very much based not just on we're all Americans and we have to take care of each other, but that we have a very explicit adversary that's trying to destroy us and undermine us. And the politics becomes based upon and centered around this idea of there's us and then there's them, and we got to somehow get rid of them or defeat them. And them can be another country, historically the French or the Germans, or, to use the other example from that history, it can be an internal enemy, the Jews, or it can be, illegal immigrants, so what have you. But it's a politics based very much, not on a kind of implicit assumption that things have to be in the national interest, but on the idea that there is a force out there or inside that's trying to subvert the nation and that we have to bind together against it.
Do you agree with David Goodhart that it's perfectly legitimate to be concerned by changes in state and society as a result of heavy immigration?
Well, it's not... is it legitimate the right term? It happens. It's part of us. We grow up in certain kinds of neighborhoods and cultures. It means more for some people than others. I wrote this recently. I wrote an essay on the election in 2018, drawing upon David Goodhart's analysis of Britain and the idea that for many of the people who backed Trump, let's say in 2016, they were people who over the last 30, 40 years had a lot of elements of their identity stripped away. Neighborhoods, bars, local churches, what have you, and for whom it the nation became very important, the national identity and the flag. And it's not that it's not important for somebody like me who lives in the suburbs of a very fancy place and has all kinds of different sources of identity and immortality, including the books that I write, but that it's more important. And for somebody who, let's say, lives in Muncie, Indiana, it's going to be more upsetting if suddenly all the old neighborhood becomes signs in Spanish, let's say. So it's not it's not a question of whether it's legitimate. It is part of our what happens politically in countries, and we have to deal with it somewhere. And we can't say, well, these people shouldn't feel this way. They do, and how are we going to accommodate them? How are we going to reconcile these different parts of the country? And what you get a lot, let's say, with the immigration is what Rehan Salam in his new book on immigration calls the backlash paradox, where people go from saying yeah, it's very bad to resent these people because they have different languages, etc., to the other extreme, saying yes, and we should just forget about these concerns and let everybody have open borders. The more the merrier, and not worry about having so many illegal immigrants in the country. And that's not a viable political position, and it doesn't do justice to the kind of concerns that many people have.
Is it at all possible, as you seem to imply in the book, that there could be a political modus vivendi between a Trumpian or neo-Trumpian view of immigration and, say, a New York Times view of immigration? In the case of the latter, that people have a human right to move or migrate to any place in the world that they so wish.
Oh, what you describe as the New York Times view?
I'm using New York Times as
I don't know if that's an accurate. I mean, the people who have that view more are like maybe the Wall Street Journal editorial page, the Cato Institute, and some people on the Democratic Socialists of America, Vox, that kind of neoliberal publication from Washington. So it's not I'm not sure if the New York Times has that extreme a view, but it hasn't worked. It clearly hasn't worked in the European Union. That's why you have a rise of the populist right in the last 20, 30 years. So completely open borders? No, I don't think that that's a viable position. But
is there a political...
Yes, we need to have some immigration in America, obviously, and other countries like Japan, it's an urgent priority right now because they have shrinking and aging populations.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
But is there a political solution which will amalgamate both positions in an acceptable fashion that we can pass laws and then move on after that?
Right now there isn't, and I just use the example of the United States. The most basic conflict is over border regulation and the illegal immigrants within the country. And I believe that we have to have some kind of a path to citizenship for the people who have come here. The estimates go from now that you see 7 or 8 million, but there's also an estimate of 22 million who are a kind of unassimilated underclass and very easily exploited. So that's one thing to do. But the other thing to do is some kind of very strict enforcement of our laws, so that an employer who hires somebody has to verify that they're in the country illegally. But if you have that kind of enforcement, and then you don't do anything about giving people a path to citizenship, what you'll do is really drive people underground. And I think that's a very bad thing to do. But the parties, the attempt to pass legislation that would reconcile those two has failed. 2007-2013, it's partly because the Democrats aren't really serious about the enforcement or its business, and the Republicans are afraid that if we have more let's say Hispanics in America who can vote, they'll vote the Democrat. Now, I'm not saying that those are realistic fears necessarily, but that's been causing this kind of irreconcilable conflict. I think in sometime in the next decade or so, if you get a cessation of the kind of terrorist attacks like the one we had in Strasbourg yesterday, it may be possible to make some kind of a reasonable compromise. Because one of the things too that makes immigration such a toxic issue is the fusion of that with the fear of terrorism. Which really makes people not want to let anybody in the country or let anybody of a certain kind in the country. So,
and
every time you think that we've reached a new point and ISIS is gone and whatever, you get something like happened yesterday.
Can President Trump be characterized as a sincere American nationalist?
Oh, historians are going to write books about this guy for, if there's still a universities in 30 or 40 years. I mean, it's going to become a cottage industry. Who knows? I think that what Trump really cares about, looking at his biography, are the trade issues and the Made in the USA issues. The immigration stuff, he was, when he ran for he was going to run for Reform Party candidate in 2000, and he denounced Pat Buchanan as a nativist. So I think some of that stuff is just political opportunism and playing to his base. But whether he believes it or not, again that's going to be a rich subject for people to speculate on.
How does the situation in Europe, especially in Western Europe, differ from that of the United States in terms of the debate about immigration, migration, and nationalism?
Well, it's probably different in that it's in a few ways. Some of the countries in Western Europe are really very, very prosperous, low unemployment, and emphasis really is on the culture and terror. I'd say that's true of a country like Denmark, where their version of the People's Party, the Folk Party, the Danish Folk Party, really isn't so much concerned with economics as it is with culture and violence. That on the one hand, and then I think, you know, if you go over to France, there's the combination of the two, the combination of economics and culture. But Europe has had more terrorist incidents in the last 10 years or so than the United States. I mean, we had two big ones in during the 2016 election in San Bernardino and Orlando that made a lot of difference. I have a feeling it's not as important an issue right now in the United States as it is in some of the countries in Europe. And again, it might change there if you see a reduction of the terrorist threat. I mean, just to use the current example, the immigration and illegal immigration is sort of like it's this kind of issue that's very similar to universal health care. It just depends on who is making the case. Now, I think Trump benefited in 2016 from the fear of terrorism and from his various promises to build a wall. I think that a lot of people didn't take that stuff seriously, but the people who did flocked to the polls, even if they were Democrats and voted for Trump. Now he's in the position where sort of the shoe is on the other foot, and he's making these demands, let's say, for his wall, and he's going to shut down the government if the Congress doesn't vote $5 billion for the wall. I think that the issue is actually going to play against him. I don't think that there is sufficient support for doing something like that. So it just depends. I guess what I'm saying is that in the United States, I don't think it's as central as an issue as it has been in some of the European countries.
You seem not to be entirely negative about President Trump's trade policies. Why is that?
Well, because I think that the trade policies of the Democrats and Republicans beginning in the 1990s, the idea that we could have a World Trade Organization and let China in and that they would eventually become just like us, liberal democratic countries that would play by the same rules have not worked. And Trump is probably the first president to really call them on this. I have some misgivings about how he's going about it, but I don't have misgivings about the idea that there is a problem of cyber theft, technology transfer, blocking our exports there while we don't block theirs here. In other words, an imbalance, and that we didn't suffer as a country from that over the last 15 years or so. estimates of, you know, between 2 and 4 million jobs lost, many of whom come out of those countries, out of those states in the middle America and in the South that supported Trump in 2016.
How does the potential for artificial intelligence, with some economists predicting 20, 30 years hence that a considerable number of low-income employment, manual employment that many first-generation immigrants tend to take up will, in fact, disappear. How will that state of affairs affect migration or immigration, legal or illegal, as a whole?
Oh, you know, this is like one of those questions about space travel or something. I don't, you know, it's the economists who do those kind of studies. What they mostly emphasize is that the that automation has destroyed the mid-wage jobs, jobs where let's say somebody worked in a factory and did primarily manual labor, but was sustained by a union, let's say on an automobile assembly line. It hasn't yet destroyed jobs, let's say home health care aides that involve personal contact, but they're also very low wage, and are a lot of the people who work in those jobs are immigrants. So it's going to, you know, the... I don't want to speak. I'm not an expert on this subject, so you know, it's. I'll just talk generally about automation, which I have thought about, rather than specifically about artificial intelligence or, you know, driverless cars. I think it's going to affect the economy across the board, but we've shown a capacity in the past for inventing all new areas of work. And in America, there are like hundreds of thousands of yoga instructors now. And don't go look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's actually true. So there is a whole dimension of personal work, of service work, that I think will grow as a result of automation. How that will affect the politics of immigration. You know, again, we're talking about something that where there's so many different factors involved that I can't really give you a good answer.
And what about universal basic income? How would that affect? I suppose if the supposition of that type of policy is that if you're a citizen, you have a right to have minimum income, wouldn't that put a certain stress on birthright citizenship? Because otherwise you could have potentially millions of people who would migrate to country X purely for the right to claim this particular income, which may be, if you're talking about migrating from a third world country to first world country, 10 or 15 times greater income that they could ever potentially hope for in their country of birth.
You've stated the case perfectly. I don't need to comment.
Okay.
You're correct. Yes, it's a problem. And in the United States, it's a political problem because we believe in the Protestant ethics. We grew up as a country with it, and with the idea that people should work for a living. So I'm not a big fan of that kind of politics. I think it could work in other countries, but I think that we have a long way to go in the United States in convincing people that we should have a program that does that. I mean, it can come across the transom disguised in other ways, in terms of providing all kinds of basic services that we need, like health care. But just a straight universal basic income, I'm not sure we're gonna get that.
In your conclusion, you differentiate between globalism and internationalism. What is the difference?
Oh, you know, I just you authors have to make something up to make a point. I think the difference is that sometimes when you hear people attack globalization or globalism, what they mean really is letting corporations, multinational corporations, have free rein. And that if we do that, sort of on the model of how Adam Smith used to think of national economies, everybody in the end will come out for the better. And that idea is not a good idea. On the other hand, there are a lot of problems in the world, pandemics, nuclear proliferation, climate change, that you can only address internationally through some kind of agreements with other countries that by their nature are going to cede some degree of sovereignty to an agreement, to a treaty, to an organization. And that's what I would identify as internationalism. And I think that that's should be an important part of what America does. And it's in our national interest to pursue internationalism in that sense.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Oh, I don't know. That I'm a great genius and will live forever. I don't have a good answer to that question.
Well, regardless of that, I think people will take away from your book that you've offered up for discussion and debate a useful view of American nationalism, nationalism in Europe, and how that intersects with the current, I wouldn't say crises, but certainly major public debate about issues related to migration, immigration, and political identity and citizenship. So with that...
Yeah, you've done it. You've said it better than me. thank you very much.
So with that being said, I would like to thank you very much, John, for being so kind to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. Thank you, John.
Sure. Bye.
Goodbye.